Escuelas Oficiales de Idiomas de la Región de Murcia. Pruebas específicas de certificación. Inglés. Nivel B2. Bilingüe. Convocatoria septiembre 2021. Comprensión de textos orales.
Task 1. You will hear a biography of singer Amy Winehouse. For items 1 to 8, choose the statements which are true according to the recording, as shown in example 0. You will hear the recording twice.
Now you have 2 minutes to read the task before the audio starts.
Amy Jade Winehouse was born to Jewish parents, a window panel installer called Mitchell Winehouse, and a pharmacist called Janice on the 14th of September 1983 at Chase Farm Hospital in North London. She lived with her parents and her older brother Alex in the Southgate area of London, where she also attended the Osage Primary School and Jewish Sunday School, although she was never overtly religious and only attended synagogue once per year on Yom Kippur, out of respect. Amy Winehouse grew up surrounded by music, especially jazz, with many of her uncles being jazz musicians on her mother's side of the family, and her father's mother being a singer, who once dated jazz saxophonist Ronnie Scott. Amy's mother and father encouraged her interest in jazz, even though they split up when she was about 9 years old, with her living with her mother and staying with her father at weekends. In 1992, encouraged by her grandmother, Amy attended the Susie Earnshaw Theatre School, where not only did she develop her vocal capabilities, but she also learned to tap dance. During that time, she got her first taste of performing in a group when she formed a rap group called Sweet and Sour with a friend. This was short-lived, though, and soon afterwards she enrolled full-time at the Sylvia Young Theatre School before moving on to the Mount School and then the Brit School in Croydon. At about the age of 15, around the time she changed schools, Amy bought herself a guitar and started to write songs. She also sang with a local group called the Bolsha Band and earned a living as an entertainment journalist. After becoming the featured female vocalist with the National Youth Jazz Orchestra in 2000, a friend of Amy's, the soul singer Tyler James, sent her demo tape to an A&R person, following which Amy signed to 19 Management, which was owned by Simon Fuller, where she was paid £250 per week. So Soon afterwards, Amy Winehouse was signed to Island Records, and her first album, called Frank, was released on the 20th of October 2003. All of the songs on the album were influenced by jazz, apart from two covers, and were co-written by Amy, with production being handled by Salaam Remy. Frank was a critical success and was nominated for a Mercury Music Prize in 2004, and Amy was nominated in the British Female Solo Artist category at the Brit Awards that year. Amy had been battling, sometimes quite publicly, with alcohol and substance abuse, and had sought treatment on a number of occasions, but on the afternoon of the 23rd of July 2011, her bodyguard found her unresponsive on her bed and called an ambulance. Amy was pronounced dead at the scene, and police took bottles of vodka into evidence. The coroner's inquest reached a verdict of misadventure, and the report indicated that she had died of alcohol poisoning. She was 27 years old.
Now, listen again.
Amy Jade Winehouse was born to Jewish parents, a window panel installer called Mitchell Winehouse, and a pharmacist called Janice on the 14th of September 1983 at Chase Farm Hospital in North London. She lived with her parents and her older brother Alex in the Southgate area of London, where she also attended the Osage Primary School and Jewish Sunday School, although she was never overtly religious and only attended synagogue once per year on Yom Kippur, out of respect. Amy Winehouse grew up surrounded by music, especially jazz, with many of her uncles being jazz musicians on her mother's side of the family, and her father's mother being a singer, who once dated jazz saxophonist Ronnie Scott. Amy's mother and father encouraged her interest in jazz, even though they split up when she was about 9 years old, with her living with her mother and staying with her father at weekends. In 1992, encouraged by her grandmother, Amy attended the Susie Earnshaw Theatre School, where not only did she develop her vocal capabilities, but she also learned to tap dance. During that time, she got her first taste of performing in a group when she formed a rap group called Sweet and Sour with a friend. This was short-lived, though, and soon afterwards she enrolled full-time at the Sylvia Young Theatre School before moving on to the Mount School and then the Brit School in Croydon. At about the age of 15, around the time she changed schools, Amy bought herself a guitar and started to write songs. She also sang with a local group called the Bolsha Band and earned a living as an entertainment journalist. After becoming the featured female vocalist with the National Youth Jazz Orchestra in 2000, a friend of Amy's, the soul singer Tyler James, sent her demo tape to an A&R person, following which Amy signed to 19 Management, which was owned by Simon Fuller, where she was paid £250 per week. Soon afterwards, Amy Winehouse was signed to Island Records, and her first album, called Frank, was released on the 20th of October 2003. All of the songs on the album were influenced by jazz, apart from two covers, and were co-written by Amy, with production being handled by Salaam Remy. Frank was a critical success and was nominated for a Mercury Music Prize in 2004, and Amy was nominated in the British Female Solo Artist category at the Brit Awards that year. Amy had been battling, sometimes quite publicly, with alcohol and substance abuse and had sought treatment on a number of occasions. But on the afternoon of the 23rd of July 2011, her bodyguard found her unresponsive on her bed and called an ambulance. Amy was pronounced dead at the scene and police took bottles of vodka into evidence. The coroner's inquest reached a verdict of misadventure, and the report indicated that she had died of alcohol poisoning. She was 27 years old.
Task 2. You will hear a TED Talk called Try Something New for 30 Days. For items 1 to 8, choose the best option, A, B, or C, according to what is said. Item 0 has been done for you as an example.
Now you have 2 minutes to read the task before the audio starts.
A few years ago, I felt like I was stuck in a rut, so I decided to follow in the footsteps of the great American philosopher, Morgan Spurlock, and try something new for 30 days. The idea is actually pretty simple. Think about something you've always wanted to add to your life and try it for the next 30 days. It turns out 30 days is just about the right amount of time to add a new habit or subtract a habit, like watching the news, from your life. There's a few things that I learned while doing these 30-day challenges. The first was, instead of the months flying by forgotten, the time was much more memorable. This was part of a challenge I did to take a picture every day for a month, and I remember exactly where I was and what I was doing that day. I also noticed that as I started to do more and harder 30-day challenges, my self-confidence grew. I went from desk-dwelling computer nerd to the kind of guy who bikes to work for fun. Even last year, I ended up hiking up Mount Kilimanjaro, the highest mountain in Africa. I would never have been that adventurous before I started my 30-day challenges. I also figured out that if you really want something badly enough, you can do anything for 30 days. Have you ever wanted to write a novel? Every November, tens of thousands of people try to write their own 50,000-word novel from scratch in 30 days. It turns out, all you have to do is write 1,667 words a day for a month. So I did. By the way, the secret is not to go to sleep until you've written your words for the day. You might be sleep-deprived, but you'll finish your novel. Now, is my book the next great American novel? No! I wrote it in a month! It's awful! But for the rest of my life, if I meet John Hodgman at a TED party, I don't have to say, I'm a computer scientist. No, no. If I want to, I can say, I'm a novelist. So here's one last thing I'd like to mention. I learned that when I made small, sustainable changes, things I could keep doing, they were more likely to stick. There's nothing wrong with big, crazy challenges. In fact, they're a ton of fun, but they're less likely to stick. When I gave up sugar for 30 days, day 31 looked like this. So here's my question to you. What are you waiting for? I guarantee you the next 30 days are going to pass whether you like it or not. So why not think about something you have always wanted to try and give it a shot for the next 30 days? Thanks.
Now, listen again.
A few years ago, I felt like I was stuck in a rut. So I decided to follow in the footsteps of the great American philosopher, Morgan Spurlock, and try something new for 30 days. The idea is actually pretty simple. Think about something you've always wanted to add to your life and try it for the next 30 days. It turns out, 30 days is just about the right amount of time to add a new habit or subtract a habit, like watching the news, from your life. There's a few things that I learned while doing these 30-day challenges. The first was, instead of the months flying by forgotten, the time was much more memorable. This was part of a challenge I did to take a picture every day for a month, and I remember exactly where I was and what I was doing that day. I also noticed that as I started to do more and harder 30-day challenges, my self-confidence grew. I went from desk-dwelling computer nerd to the kind of guy who bikes to work for fun. Even last year, I ended up hiking up Mount Kilimanjaro, the highest mountain in Africa. I would never have been that adventurous before I started my 30-day challenges. I also figured out that if you really want something badly enough, you can do anything for 30 days. Have you ever wanted to write a novel? Every November, tens of thousands of people try to write their own 50,000-word novel from scratch in 30 days. It turns out, all you have to do is write 1,667 words a day for a month. So I did. By the way, the secret is not to go to sleep until you've written your words for the day. You might be sleep deprived, but you'll finish your novel. Now, is my book the next great American novel? No, I wrote it in a month. It's awful. But for the rest of my life, if I meet John Hodgman at a TED party, I don't have to say, I'm a computer scientist. No, no. If I want to, I can say, I'm a novelist. So here's one last thing I'd like to mention. I learned that when I made small, sustainable changes, things I could keep doing, they were more likely to stick. There's nothing wrong with big, crazy challenges. In fact, they're a ton of fun, but they're less likely to stick. When I gave up sugar for 30 days, day 31 looked like this. So here's my question to you. What are you waiting for? I guarantee you the next 30 days are going to pass whether you like it or not. So why not think about something you have always wanted to try and give it a shot for the next 30 days? Thanks.
Task 3. You will hear part of a radio show about health, where they are talking about losing the sense of touch. For items 1 to 10, fill in the gaps with one or two words, as in example 0.
Now you have 2 minutes to read the task before the audio starts.
Hello, if you've been listening to Radio 4 much this week, you might have heard of the touch test by now. Perhaps you were one of the 40,000 people who took part in this online study. And if you did, you might remember a section on touch in healthcare. And that's what we're going to focus on in this special edition of Inside Health. What if psychotherapists were allowed to give a distressed client a hug? And apart from the physical examination, how much touch goes on in the consultation room?
Sometimes a hand on the shoulder, if appropriate. Rarely a hug. Sometimes small children are very keen to enthusiastically greet you, which is always lovely.
To discuss the practicalities and ethics involved in touch in health settings, I'm joined by Deborah Bowman, who's Professor of Bioethics at St George's University, and Dr Natalie Bowling is here. She's a psychologist from the University of Greenwich, and along with colleagues at Goldsmiths University, she created and analysed the touch test. Welcome to both of you. Let me ask you, Natalie, do you hug your doctor?
I've never hugged my doctor. I think I'd find it slightly odd, actually.
Yeah. And what about you, Deborah?
Oh, gosh. Do you know, I did hug my oncologist, but we weren't in a clinical setting. We were at a conference together and I asked first.
Oh, well, hugging at conferences, that's different, isn't it, I guess? Now,
always.
We're going to start with how essential the sense of touch can be for patients and for doctors. Sight and sound might dominate our world, but if we start to lose the sense of touch, even a bit, the result can be profound. Anne Townsend is 82. She's not only a qualified doctor, but a priest and a psychotherapist. She has lost some of her sense of touch as a side effect of chemotherapy for cancer.
It was a huge deprivation for me to lose touch. From when I was a little girl, I learned to knit, to crochet, to tat. Particularly, I love patchwork and quilting and feeling the different textures of fabrics, the velvets and the cottons and the silks, and blending them all together into a quilt. I can't hold a needle now. I can't hold scissors. So not to have that when I'm, let's say it, when I'm dying of cancer has been something really, really hard.
Deborah, you've had similar problems with what's called peripheral neuropathy. How's it affected you?
Well, do you know, I've been very lucky and I wouldn't want to compare myself at all to Anne. But when I was told about it, I thought, well, gosh, you know, how bad can it be compared to having cancer, I guess. And I was so wrong. I remember watching my function deteriorate and having to choose clothes so that I couldn't wear something with buttons, for example. And I have nothing like Anne's talent in terms of crafting, but I do recognise and empathise with what it's like to have that very fundamental sensation taken away.
And Anne mentioned feeling the touch of the different fabrics.
Now, listen again.
Hello, if you've been listening to Radio 4 much this week, you might have heard of the touch test by now. Perhaps you were one of the 40,000 people who took part in this online study. And if you did, you might remember a section on touch in healthcare. And that's what we're going to focus on in this special edition of Inside Health. What if psychotherapists were allowed to give a distressed client a hug? And apart from the physical examination, how much touch goes on in the consultation room?
Sometimes a hand on the shoulder, if appropriate. Rarely a hug. Sometimes small children are very keen to enthusiastically greet you, which is always lovely.
To discuss the practicalities and ethics involved in touch in health settings, I'm joined by Deborah Bowman, who's Professor of Bioethics at St George's University, and Dr. Natalie Bowling is here. She's a psychologist from the University of Greenwich, and along with colleagues at Goldsmiths University, she created and analysed the touch test. Welcome to both of you. Let me ask you, Natalie, do you hug your doctor?
I've never hugged my doctor. I think I'd find it slightly odd, actually.
Yeah. And what about you, Deborah?
Oh, gosh. Do you know, I did hug my oncologist, but we weren't in a clinical setting. We were at a conference together and I asked first.
Oh, well, hugging at conferences, that's different, isn't it, I guess? Now,
always.
We're going to start with how essential the sense of touch can be for patients and for doctors. Sight and sound might dominate our world, but if we start to lose the sense of touch, even a bit, the result can be profound. Anne Townsend is 82. She's not only a qualified doctor, but a priest and a psychotherapist. She has lost some of her sense of touch as a side effect of chemotherapy for cancer.
It was a huge deprivation for me to lose touch. From when I was a little girl, I learned to knit, to crochet, to tat. Particularly, I love patchwork and quilting and feeling the different textures of fabrics, the velvets and the cottons and the silks, and blending them all together into a quilt. I can't hold a needle now. I can't hold scissors. So not to have that when I'm, let's say it, when I'm dying of cancer has been something really, really hard.
Deborah, you've had similar problems with what's called peripheral neuropathy. How's it affected you?
Well, do you know, I've been very lucky and I wouldn't want to compare myself at all to Anne. But when I was told about it, I thought, well, gosh, you know, how bad can it be compared to having cancer, I guess. And I was so wrong. I remember watching my function deteriorate and having to choose clothes so that I couldn't wear something with buttons, for example. And I have nothing like Anne's talent in terms of crafting, but I do recognise and empathise with what it's like to have that very fundamental sensation taken away.
And Anne mentioned feeling the touch of the different fabrics.
Fin de la prueba.